Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour on Monday, November 17, 2014, with me, Carolyn Yeager, your host. Well, I have to say it is a relief to see the sun today. It's been a wonderful day after a couple of not very good days, not just weather-wise, but all kinds of things happening. But today was bright, and my website was back up, and I didn't expect to see it when I got up this morning, but there it was. So things happen. I'm not the best person for understanding how these things work on the computer technology. But, when these attacks happen, I think they're just going to keep going on and on. But they do seem to only have so much ammunition, then they stop. In any event, that's what appeared to have happened. And so it was a very good day, and tomorrow is my brother's birthday. So I thought I'd mention it. You know, my brother, that Hungarian, who was president of the Chicago Hungarian Club. Of course, my brother was not Hungarian, and neither am I, nor was anyone else in my family. I can't seem to get that across to people who don't want to understand how these things work. So we just have to let that go. I'm about ready to just let that go. I made a few changes on my ancestry today. Just realized, I thought, well, maybe some of these sentences aren't written carefully enough and they're not clear enough, and I should clarify a few things. So I did that, and I hope that does help. With mentioned Thanksgiving is coming up. My brother always loved Thanksgiving as a little boy. That was seemed to be his favorite holiday. He liked the family togetherness, I think. So Thanksgiving is coming up, and I'm going to take some time off for it. I'm going to probably not do a show on Saturday the 22nd or on Monday the 24th. That will be my holiday there. And I don't know about Table Talk, since it's on a Thursday. I haven't talked to Ray about it yet. We will be doing Table Talk this coming Thursday. Then we could do it on a Wednesday or on a Friday, or just not do it at all that week. I'll find out, but we'll know by this coming Thursday, and I'll announce it on our next Table Talk show. So tonight's topic is the Ukrainians, and this probably will be the last program on the Hitler and the Slavs, which is part six now, but someone had written a comment and brought up the Ukrainians, and I thought, gee, I've still got this ethnic cleansing material to go over, and this would be a good way to include it in a whole show about Ukraine. And I'm very interested in the Ukrainians myself, so I enjoyed looking into this. I didn't maybe spend as much time as with so many things going on as I could have, but I don't think there was too much more to discover. So I think this, about as much as I would have brought forth, even if I had a whole lot of time to do it. So. The question I want to ask in this program, basically, is that the Ukrainians are described as an East Slavic ethnic group that are native to Ukraine. And I think I understand that now. I see how that works. Because I was asking the questions, well, how did the Slavs get there, since it didn't begin, the first kingdoms weren't Slavic. But, and so it was like, when did it become Slav? When did it switch over to Slavic rule? And questions like that. So I think those will be answered. I'll try to bring that up again at the end and see if they have been answered. And, of course, I might have time for phone calls tonight if anybody wants to call later on. The number is, the guest call-in is 323-642-1206. In the second hour, after a little while, probably the best way to do it. And I think after all those phone calls on Saturday, I think I have an understanding now of what this phone board looks like and the order that the calls come in, because I had it backwards. I do tend to get things backwards. I'll go into that sometime, maybe, talking about that. I realize that's always been there with me, getting things backwards. But I'm not dyslexic, and it's nothing like that. I don't see words wrong, right? It's not words. It's just things like right and left, stop and go, red and, you know, red and green. I start thinking backwards about it. All right, I'm going to start here with, since the dissolution of the Soviet Union, Ukraine continues to maintain the second largest military in Europe after that of the Russian Federation, when reserves and paramilitary personnel are taken into account. That is, it's kind of surprising. Then I realized that a reason for that could be that Ukraine is not a part of NATO. It's not a part of the West. It wasn't really that much a part of the West. It was still very much connected to Russia, and they had a big military when the Soviet Union collapsed, and they kept that for quite a while. They still have it because they feel they need to defend themselves from a lot of things. So, but it's mostly in reserves and paramilitary personnel. They're really suffering today because they really don't have enough to defend themselves against a highly militarized country like Russia. So, I do feel sorry for the Ukrainians, and so I have a more sympathetic attitude on this program to the subject matter, the subject people I'm talking about, than I did on the previous ones. But Ukraine is a rather poor country in many, many ways. So they're not the most likely people to have great success, but they really have a lot of good qualities, it seems to me. I think there's a lot of dissimilarity or diversity, a lot of different strains in Ukraine, because some of the people are so good looking and some of the people are not at all, and some of the people seem to be so progressive and hope for a better future, and so many others are just kind of slovenly, it seems like, and are not used to having much. They've been quite poor. And they, you know, Ukrainians have been treated so badly throughout the whole 20th century, let's say, at least, and no doubt before that. But they just, they've suffered a lot. So I'll continue now. It says that the country is home to 45.4 million people, and that includes Crimea. You know, now compare that to Ukraine is the biggest landmass of a European country, west or east, other than Russia. It's bigger than any of the others. Of course, they don't have as many people as Germany, and they're much, much bigger. But they have more people than Poland. Poland has 38.5 million people, and for all these countries, it has to include those who. Well, the Ukrainians are not able to go out into Europe the way because they're not a member of the European Union. So, but the Poles and the Czechs, their population has to include those who are currently outside of their country and are working in the West, but they're just on worker permits. But there's a lot of them, but they're still citizens of Poland or the Czech Republic. Well, so Poland has quite a bit, but not a whole lot, less than Ukraine in population. Poland is a big country, too. But the Czech are only 10 million. So that was in, like, 2013 census, something like that. They're very small people. So of these 45.4 million people, million Ukrainians, 77.8% are Ukrainian by ethnicity. And 17% are Russian by ethnicity. So there's not as many Russians in Ukraine as you might think, although that's not a small number. And then along with that, in Ukraine there are Romanians, Moldovians, or it's Romanians / Moldovians, Belarusians, Crimean Tatars, Crimean Tatars, and Hungarians, but they're negligible, really. Ukrainian is the official language of Ukraine. Its alphabet is Cyrillic, although Russian is still widely spoken. The dominant religion in the country is Eastern Orthodox, which has strongly influenced Ukrainian architecture, literature, and music. Now, the etymology of the name, and I've got some little more detail about these things further on than I'm saying right now, but it is, according to the older and most widespread hypothesis, it means borderland. Well, that's what the Russians favor. The Russians favor that Ukraine means borderland, and more recent linguistic studies claim a different meaning, that it means homeland or region or country. So, see, and this is what the Ukrainians favor, because they want to be a separate country and a separate, have their own have it as their homeland, and the Russians want to think of it as a borderland of Russia. That's an ongoing debate. Then who settled there, when and why? In modern human settlement in Ukraine and its vicinity dates back to 32,000 BC, with evidence of the Gravettian culture. I've read about that Gravettian culture before. We're talking again 32,000 BC, and the Gravettian culture evidence is in the Crimean Mountains. By 4,500 BC, the Neolithic Kukulteni Tripilian culture flourished in a wide area that included parts of modern Ukraine, including Tripilia and the entire Dniester region. Now, you know, there's no way to say what these people were. They're Neolithic. These were not Slavic people. These were just some early humans who were there. During the Iron Age, the land was inhabited by Sumerians, Scythians, and Sarmatians. And Scythians and Sarmatians are both come from Iran, the Iranian regions, and so on. So that's basically something Iranian. And there was a lot of evidence of a high culture there with jewelry, gold jewelry, and lots of beautiful things that they crafted. But that was a long time ago, the Iron Age. And then between 700 BC and 200 BC, still in BC, it was part of the Scythian kingdom, or it was called Scythia. Again, that's Iranian. So later colonies of ancient Greece, ancient Rome, and the Byzantine Empire were such as Tiris, Olbia, O-L-B-I-A, and Hermonassa, were founded beginning in the 6th century BC on the northeastern shore of the Black Sea. Of course, with that Black Sea there would be a lot of civilization going on, a lot of settlement going on. And these colonies thrived well into the 6th century, the Greek, Roman, Byzantine, and so on. At that time, now we're getting into more modern times, 6th century AD or Christian era, the Goths, which are Germanic, stayed in the area, but came under the sway of the Huns from the 370s AD on. So, of course, the 6th century is later than that, but they were the Huns showed up in the meantime while the Goths were still there and kind of took control, I guess, a little bit. And then in the 7th century AD, the territory of eastern Ukraine was the center of old Great Bulgaria. That was some kind of a civilization that was quite distinctive and powerful, I guess, at the time. At the end of the century, the majority of Bulgar tribes migrated in different directions, and the Khazars took over much of the land. Then comes the Golden Age of Kiev, and the Kievan Rus, R-U-S, with an apostrophe after it. The Kievan Rus was founded by the Rus people, who were Varangians, who first settled there around Ladoga. There's a lake, Ladoga, there, and Novgorod, then gradually moved southward, eventually reaching Kiev about 880. Now, these Varangian people were Scandinavians, And they obviously came down. In fact, they show the route. They came down from Scandinavia and eventually reached, they were migrating down there or traveling, whatever they did, maybe attacking people as they went along. I don't know, you know, for what they needed. And in 1880, they reached Kiev, and or they built Kiev there, perhaps. And their empire included the western part of modern Ukraine and Belarus. The larger part was situated on the territory of the modern Russian Federation. So it was very big, but Kiev was their capital, sort of. And according to the Primary Chronicle, the Rus elite initially consisted of these Varangians from Scandinavia. So the conquerors of the area and the elites that set themselves up as the rulers and the elite who probably had the others working for them were from Scandinavia. Now, you know, this is familiar, too, from what we learn about the Slavic, well, the Western Slavic, and now Ukraine is far enough east that it's called Eastern Slavic. But these Slavic territories, which are today these Slavic, independent Slavic nations. And it says that during the 10th and 11th centuries, this Kievan Rus became the largest and most powerful state in Europe. In the following centuries, it laid the foundation for the national identity of Ukrainians and Russians. Kiev, the capital of modern Ukraine, became the most important city of the Rus. The Varangians, or Scandinavians, later assimilated into the local Slavic population and became part of the first Rus dynasty. I guess other ones did. Or, there was the local people there. And this is the thing that I find, and it's going to be emphasized here, shown as we go through this history, that the Slavic, that these people were there. But they didn't seem to have a dominating spirit, or they didn't have build, or they didn't create, have an urge or the will to create things. And these Germanic peoples came in and had this and did this, and they were the rulers. And then they slowly mixed more and more with the Slavic people, I suppose, is what happened. Or they allowed more and more right to these people until these people were able to take over, you know, and kick them out, or, you know, turn the tables on them, which we know happens an awful lot with colonists who start out and build everything, and then the people that are there eventually are able to take it away from them and become more powerful themselves based on what these people brought to them. Did I say this, that the local Slavic population became part of the first Rus dynasty, the Rurik dynasty. And the golden age of Kievan Rus began with the reign of Vladimir the Great, who turned Rus toward Byzantine Christianity. So it was Christianity that always seemed to. Of course, this is the time when Christianity was quite militant and moving to convert people, all the peoples everywhere. So during the reign of Vladimir the Great's son, Yaroslav the Wise, who probably reigned from 1019 to 1054, or who lived during those years, Kievan Rus reached the zenith of its cultural development and military power. Kievan Rus finally disintegrated into separate principalities after 1132. The reason that happened was because it said that they lost their leadership. The leadership disintegrated or didn't follow through, didn't continue like it should. That caused them to break apart into separate individual regions. Their rulers were able to do what they wanted and say, well, you know, we're breaking away from you. And the center didn't hold, let's say. So that was the decline of Kievan Rus. In the 13th century, because they were now in, you know, a bunch of separate principalities, the Mongol invasion came along and devastated Kievan Rus. The state of Kievan Rus was succeeded eventually by the principalities of Halych, H-A-L-Y-C-H, and Volodymyr Volinsky. which emerged later into the state of Galicia, Volhynia. You know, I've talked about Volhynia before, Volhynia. So in the 14th century, the state of Galicia, Volhynia declined and became part of Poland until in 1772, the Austro-Hungarian Empress Maria Theresia revived the old Hungarian claim to Galicia, and then Galicia became a part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Empire. So that's a short and brief history up to that point. Now, speaking about the Ukrainians, here we go back to the ethnonym, it's called, the ethnonym Ukrainians. The word Ukrainians became widely accepted only in the 20th century, when the territory finally obtained its own statehood in 1917. Now, something I noticed here in reading about Ukraine in the pages that that they have on Wikipedia, yes, they're not making a lot of claims like the Poles and the Czechs have done about their glorious history, and they seem to be pretty honest about it, and one thing that's clear is that they didn't get it together until far more recently, and they don't try to say otherwise. So we go on in the 14th to the 16th century, the territories of Ukraine and Belarus, which is Western Rus, were largely known as Rus, continuing the tradition of Kievan Rus, the first East Slavic state. Repeats again. That was the first East Slavic state, Kievan Rus. People of these territories were usually called Rus or Rusyns, R-U-S-Y-N-S, known, though, as Ruthenians in Western and Central Europe. And I wonder if that's pronounced more Ruthenians or Ruthenians than Ruthenians, as we say it in English. Maybe the H is silent. And I don't. Ruthenian is a name for the Ukrainians, but they were at that time called Ruthenians, and Ukraine, the name Ukrainians, as is trying to point out here, didn't really take hold until later. So it says the Ukrainian language appeared in the 14th to 16th centuries, with some prototypical features already in the 11th century, but at that time it was mostly known as Ruthenian. I'm just going to go ahead with the Ruthenians pronunciation so you know what I'm... you can distinguish one name from the other. In the 16th and 17th centuries, with the establishment of the Zaporizhian Sich, S-I-C-K, the notion of Ukraine as a separate country with a separate ethnic identity came into being. In the 16th, 17th centuries, 1600s. However, the ethnonym Ukrainians and the linguonym Ukrainian were used only occasionally, and the people of Ukraine usually continued to call themselves and their language Ruthenian. The people that are here, the people that make up this area here, are the people. Mostly these people who were here ruled over by these Scandinavian Varangians in the beginning, and their great empire, you'd call it that, Kievan Rus, was named by the Scandinavians, and it also was the beginning of Russia. So what we had here, it seems to me that, you know, a lot of people hanging around. I've already said this, I'll say it again. A lot of people who were living around in here who had not done much of anything, you know. They were just living the most primitive, maybe the most simple life, and then they became part of these states. Then they declined and deteriorated to some degree, and so then you had these people, and they were still in the process of development as to what they were. And so this Zaporizhian Sich, that has to be Ukrainian, I guess, name, which is a historical territory around today's Kashovka Reservoir. It's a historical territory around this famous reservoir that is in the Ukraine territory, the Kiev and Rus territory. After the decline of this historical territory and the establishment of Imperial Russian hegemony in Ukraine, Ukrainians were better known by the Russian regional name Little Russians, or Malorossi, with the majority of Ukrainian elites, whoever they were, being followers of the Little Russian identity. This official name, usually regarded now as colonial and humiliating, did not spread widely among the peasantry, which constituted the majority of the population. So it looks like, it's hard to follow this, it seems like things are left out, but the Russians kind of moved in and took over, and these Ukrainians were not people who stood up for themselves that much, or who could, as I said before, really got it together. So the Russians were naming them and saying what they were and who they were and so on. And there had to have been something about the Russians. I mean, there's no year for this. So it sounds like the Russians came from Kiev and Rus, but suddenly they had more authority over the native Ukrainians. The majority of the population didn't take this name on. You know, the elites liked it. The elites, whoever these elites were, they call them Ukrainian elites. I guess it was the Ukrainian elites. You know, there's always elites who move up. And so they took the name Little Russia or Little Russian from the Russians. But the people didn't, the peasantry didn't ever use it. And they still refer to their country as Ukraine, a name associated with this Zaporizhian Sich and the Hetmanate, and their struggle against Poles, Russians, Turks, and Crimean Tatars. And to themselves and their language, they referred to their country as Ukraine, and they referred to themselves and their language as Ruthenians and Ruthenian. So the Ruthenians lived in Ukraine, according to them. And I can see the similarity in the names. You know, Ruthenian rhymes with Ukrainian, or where these differences come from, I don't know. But moving on to the Ukrainian language. With the publication of Ivan Kotliarevsky's Aeneid, so they have it in a different language there, but it's he published the Aeneid, you know, the Greek Aeneid in 1798. And that, I guess he published it in Ukrainian. And that established the modern Ukrainian language. 1798, and almost 1800. You know, of course, the printing press has been going since the 1500s. This kind of was the establishment or benchmark for the Ukrainian language and the subsequent romantic revival of national traditions and culture. The ethnonym Ukrainians and the notion of the Ukrainian language came into being at the beginning of the 19th century. That's what it seems like it's repeating what I just said there, and gradually replaced the words Russians and Ruthenians. So they became now Ukrainian in the beginning of the 19th century. In areas that were not under the control of the Russian Soviet state until the 20th century, that is the part that is known as Western Ukraine, the Ukrainians were known by their pre-existing names for much longer. The appellation Ukrainians initially came into common usage in central Ukraine and did not take hold in Galicia and Bukovina until the later part of the 19th century, in Transcarpathia until the 1930s, and not in the Prestov region until the late 1940s. Wow. The modern name, Ukrainian, derives from Ukraine, a name first documented in 1187. Several scientific theories attempt to explain the etymology of the term. Here we go again with the etymology where I already mentioned this, but I'll read this because it says that Ukrainian historians, now see these are the Ukrainian side, such as couple of names they give, and other scholars, translate the term Ukraine as that is U-U-Crane as in hyphen land or home hyphen land or our hyphen country. The name, see, meaning, you know, homeland or inland. The name in this context derives from the word Ukraina, in the sense of domestic region, domestic land or country, or inside, meaning inside the country. According to some Russian scholars, the word derives from the Proto-Slavic root kraj, K-R-A-J, meaning edge, border, and originally had the sense of periphery, borderland, or frontier region. See, I already explained that, and that's pretty obvious what people are trying to do there. In the last few centuries, the population of Ukraine was subjected to periods of Polonization and Russification, that's not surprising, but preserved a common culture and a sense of common identity. In other words, and I think it bears out too when you look at it, that the Poles and the Russians were trying to claim the Ukrainians as part of their nations and their ethnicity and so on. And they were always doing that, those two especially. The Poles were always trying to Polonize as many people as possible to become larger. And the Russians also are trying to spread their people all over to get more influence all around the world and make people connect themselves with Russia. But it says that Ukraine, in spite of all its seeming passivity, and allowing itself to be thrown here and there, or treated like this, or treated this way and that way, it did still preserve this sense of a common identity, a Ukrainian identity that they have today still. I think it's genuine what you see going on in Ukraine. I think it's mostly quite genuine, and it's rather amazing. Maybe it isn't, but you know, you have to give them, you have to say that there is something there that they have held on to who they are. Now I'm going to go through a little bit of factual information, like on population and so on. So there's been a population decline in Ukraine. They've been declining since the 1990s due to a high death rate and a low birth rate. Their population is shrinking by over 150,000 a year, it says, because, you know, they have more deaths than births. And the birth rate has recovered in recent years from a low level around 2000 and is now comparable to the European average. It would need to increase by another 50% or so to stabilize the population and offset the high mortality rate. Life expectancy is falling, and Ukraine suffers a high mortality rate from environmental pollution. Well, that's from the Russian rule and the Russian control and the, you know, the Russian way of dealing with, and before that, the Soviet way of dealing with that area, Ukraine. But also, and poor diets, which you could, they're rather poor people anyway, and maybe they don't understand good diet too well and don't have the ability to carry it out. But also, widespread smoking, extensive alcoholism, and deteriorating medical care. We've certainly heard about the alcoholism. That's a problem in Russia too, though, but it might be worse in Ukraine. Now, there are not only clear regional differences on questions of identity, but historical cleavages remain evident at the level of individual social identification. Attitudes toward the most important, in the different areas of Ukraine, the attitudes toward the most important political issue, which is relations with Russia, differed strongly between Lviv, which is in the west, and identifying more with Ukrainian nationalism, and the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, and Donetsk, which we know so much in the news recently and is in the far eastern part of Ukraine, which is predominantly Russian-oriented and favorable to the Soviet era, while in central and southern Ukraine, as well as Kiev, such divisions are less important, and there was less antipathy toward people from other regions. Well, so they're more open, more sophisticated, I suppose, more whatever, open, I'd say. But, you know, one thing it's very clear to me that there's no high culture in Ukraine. And, you know, I've looked at the culture in Poland and in the Czech Republic and also what was in Czechoslovakia. And they didn't have much either, but Ukraine has less. But they have this highly decorative weaving and embroidery there. They have folk arts, and especially their weaving and embroidery is really, really wonderful. In fact, I relate to it very much. I like it. I like a lot of things, a lot of Ukrainian things. Some of their weaving and their, something you'd make into a wall hanging is very ornate and well-developed. It's not at all. It's very sophisticated and beautiful. They have, when you see those big designs with fantastic kind of flower designs. They don't look like real flowers, but they're flowery looking and very colorful. Yeah, I've always been attracted to that kind of thing, and that's Ukrainian, the way they their folk art and their the way their imagination functions. But their literary history, which they try to give some, you know, and their different writers and so on. But of course, I've never heard of them. And I'm not saying they're not good, just like with the others, you know, but they're not anybody I recognize at all. But it said that their literary history was dependent on Christianity in the church. So when Christianity took hold, then things were written. They were written like for the church, you know, church stories, Christian stories, and maybe church history even. That's what brought it on. Before that, they didn't really have any. And they also have epic poetry, you know, that type of thing that we, you know, would call epic poetry. That was about it until recent times, when they have, you know, the usual authors and novelists and so on. Now, in architecture, again, of course, there are no architects. When they talk about Ukrainian architecture, it describes the type of architecture that you find there, which is from the past. This is motifs and styles that are found in structures, and they include initial roots which were established in the Eastern Slavic state of Kiev and Rus, and after the 12th century, the distinct architectural history continued in the principalities of Galicia, Volhynia, and, you know, you see, it's not Islamic, it's like the Byzantine style. And you also see evidence of buildings that carry the Austrian Empire style, which are more Western-looking, but very decorative, classical style, with eagles on top and so on. Then you have that onion-domed buildings, very, very brightly colored and very attractive. And of course, they're all tourist attractions, and they have a good deal of tourism in Ukraine because of their natural parks and recreational things and their natural preserves with a particular kind of animals and things they have that people go and want to see, and recreational places because of the Black Sea, of course, is a very big attraction. But there's a lot to see there, but it's probably far between. except for in Kiev and some of the bigger cities, but so that's about it, you know. There's no painting. There was some painters, but they didn't appeal to me. They were pretty primitive and not that exciting. And there was music. They have some music, but there was nothing, you know, really to talk about with the music. So no, there's not a very developed culture there. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about World War II, and then I'm going to go to the ethnic cleansing story between the Poles and Ukrainians in Volhynia during the 40s. So to introduce this part, we'll say that although the majority of Ukrainians fought alongside the Red Army and Soviet resistance, In western Ukraine, an independent Ukrainian insurgent army movement arose, which was the UPA in 1942. So, according to this, the common story is that the majority of Ukrainians fought with the Red Army, and fought with the Soviet resistance in the guerrilla warfare, which is probably true. But there was a Ukrainian insurgent army movement, which would have been right-wing and nationalist, which arose in 1942. Actually, this nationalist movement started much earlier than that. But anyway, this is what this has to do with, I guess, the wartime. So it soon fell under the influence of Nationalist Underground Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the OUN. So, you can get confused between the UPA and the OUN, but the UPA was the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, which during the 40s, when Ukraine was invaded by the Germans, came under the influence of this more passionate nationalist, more fanatical organization of Ukrainian nationalists, which they call themselves is OUN. Which had developed in interwar Poland as a radical reaction to the Polish politics toward the Ukrainian minority. Now, during this time and before this time, we know how the Poles are. They had a bunch of Ukrainians in their territory, and they were treating them in that same bad way. Well, that was part of the story of Poland already told, which is between the wars. So before 1939, they were not being kind, and I gave some stories about some of the terrible things from De Colonna's book, some of the terrible things that Poles were doing to the Ukrainians there. So the Poles had it coming back to them, and they formed the Ukrainians outside of Poland formed this, and Poland was being destroyed, you know. So now they were free to form their organizations, and they didn't have any good feelings toward the Poles, and they wanted to get the Poles out. Now, both of these organizations, the UPA and the OUN, supported the goal of an independent Ukrainian state on territory with a Ukrainian ethnic majority. Both of these organizations were nationalists. They wanted an independent Ukrainian state with just the Ukrainians in it. Although this brought conflict with Nazi Germany at times, it's true. The Germans were not wanting Ukraine to set up an independent state. They wanted to be in control of Ukraine themselves. So there was some conflict here, but even so, this Melnik wing of the OUN allied with the National Socialists because they were so much against the Soviets and the Poles, both. So now this Andriy Melnik, a little bit about him. You know, there was the Bandera wing of the OUN and the Melnik wing. So it was called OUNB and OUNM. It gets confusing. And it's spelled A-N-D-R-I-Y, Andriy, or Andriy Melnik, M-E-L-N-Y-K. He was one of the founders of the OUN in 1929, so that's where it started, 1929. And in 1940, a more radical faction of the OUN was led by Stepan Bandera and based in Ukraine, and it broke away from the OUN led by Melnik, who was in exile at the time and not doing a whole lot with it. The two rival organizations became known as the Melnikites and the Banderites. After 1938, Melnik was allegedly recruited by the German Abwehr, and the source of this is something that I'm not sure, and it says allegedly, but anyway, he did become join the German side, so they say, some people say he was recruited by the Abwehr, and very likely, and after the German invasion of the Soviet Union, this Melnik declared his own independent Ukrainian government in Rivne, competing with Bandera supporters for influence in western Ukraine. Some UPA divisions also carried out the massacres of ethnic Poles which caused also relatively smaller Polish actions in response. So they're having these, naturally, their whole policy was to remove the Poles, and they were just, you know, massacres were okay with them. With the Ukrainians now, that they had some strength on their side, and then the Poles would respond when they could and do the same back to the Ukrainians. After the war, the UPA, this is just a little something that was in there, because we're not going after the war already, but it just says that after the war, the UPA did continue to fight the USSR until the 1950s. So they really did hate the Russians and didn't want. The Russians were the biggest threat to their national independence, because the Russians always took it from the time they had any power that Ukraine was theirs, and the Ukrainians were under them and were basically just more Russians. They weren't good to the Ukrainians either. The insurgents used guerrilla war tactics, the UPA insurgents, and they targeted for assassination and terror those who they perceived as representing or cooperating with the Soviet state. So, at the same time, the Ukrainian Liberation Army was another nationalist movement that fought alongside what they called the Nazis. In total, the number of ethnic Ukrainians who fought in the ranks of the Soviet Army, according to this, is estimated from 4.5 million to 7 million. The estimates for that is probably high to make it look more pro-Soviet and anti-German. So as maybe you could say 5 million of them fought in the Soviet army against the Germans. The pro-Soviet partisan guerrilla resistance in Ukraine is estimated to number at 47,800 from the start of the occupation of Ukraine, 1941, summer, to 500,000 at its peak in 1944. So this is pro-Soviet partisan guerrilla resistance. We know there's a lot of Jews in there, the communists and Russians there too, and Jews grew from about 50,000 to 500,000 in those 3 years, with about 50%, it says, being ethnic Ukrainians. Well, maybe so, and then the rest would be Jews. 50% Jews. Then you had those, I'm just going to leave that because I can't say otherwise. That's what this says. 50% ethnic Ukrainians were part of the partisan guerrilla resistance against the Germans. Generally, the Ukrainian insurgent army's figures are not very reliable, though, it says, with figures ranging anywhere from 15,000 to as many as 100,000 fighters. You know, that's what they say they have. That's a big range from 15 to 100,000. So the vast majority of the fighting in World War II took place on the Eastern Front. It has been estimated that 93% of all German casualties took place there. The total losses inflicted upon the Ukrainian population during the war are estimated between 5 and 8 million, including an estimated 1.5 million Jews killed by the Einsatzgruppen, sometimes with the help of local collaborators. Well, I guess so. And I don't know. You see, here again, this is this stuff they put out all the time, you know, the estimates they come up with. 5 to 8 million of Ukrainians, but 1.5 million Jews were killed by the Einsatzgruppen. Now, these Ukrainians, they're not saying they were killed by the Einsatzgruppen. The 500,000 Jews were killed by the Einsatzgruppen. Well, it would be fine if they actually did, but who knows? And it says of the estimated 8.7 million Soviet troops who fell in battle against the Nazis, 1.4 million were ethnic Ukrainians. So the estimates are that 8.7, almost 9 million Soviets fell in battle, you know, fighting the Wehrmacht and the Waffen-SS and so on. And 1.25 million of these were ethnic Ukrainians. So saying that there were a lot of Ukrainians fighting in that war against the Germans, and that just makes the point, if it would need to be made, that these Ukrainians were not particularly going to be loyal to the Germans. They were going to do what they felt they had to do in order to be safe or look after themselves or, what, you know, not be murdered or something. So lots of different reasons why they would be fighting for the Soviets, because they were forced to, because a lot of them had always felt they were part of Russia, so that was their side and so on. I can't say, but we're going to look at some things in next now from Timothy Snyder. So I'm going to play a little music, and what I was going to play on Saturday, I'm going to play today. All right, I'll do it. You know, this is very light swing music. This is Charlie and his orchestra. And I like this song. It's a new one that I've gotten that actually Margaret sent to me, because, you know, I mentioned from Marcus about Charlie and his orchestra, and she came upon this, and she told me about it, and she sent it to me, and then she sent me the MP3. So it's a little over 3 minutes long. Charlie, the orchestra leader, makes a very interesting statement about Jews, so listen carefully to that. It only comes at the very beginning, and the song is Makin' Whoopee.
Have asked Eddie Cantor to write a new version of his famous old-timer Makin' Whoopee. In one of his latest programs on the air, he sang the following song. Another war, another profit, another Jewish business trick, another season, another reason for making whoopee. A lot of dough, a lot of gold, the British Empire being sold. We're in the money, thanks to Frankie, we're making whoopee. Washington is our ghetto, Roosevelt our king. Democracy is our motto, think what a war can bring. We throw our German names away, we are the kikes of USA. You are the boys, folks, we are the boys, folks, we're making whoopee.
I was actually surprised to hear that, and pretty entertaining. This is Carolyn Yeager, and I'm back for the second hour of the Heretics Hour, and we'll go as long as it takes. I'm going to be reading from some stuff here rather than reading off my computer screen, so it makes it a little more difficult. I might be making a little noise. Something that I've had for quite a while now, I don't know the year, but it's old, maybe it came out. It says here 2003. And this Timothy Snyder is a real Zionist, pro-Jewish, totally pro-Jewish. You know, and he's on the faculty at Yale University, so you know where he's coming from. But he wrote a book called The Killing Fields. Well, I don't know if that's the full title of it, but he's supposedly a scholar, an expert on Russian interior and the Einsatzgruppen and the, you know, the destruction of the Jews and during the war by the National Socialists. But I think he's pro-Polish. Definitely he is. I think so. But he's, of course, supposed to trying to be unbiased here. But he really got taken looking into the Ukrainian-Polish ethnic cleansing, as he calls it, of 1943. And so he wrote some things about this, not just this that I have, but something else, something more, which might be a part of this, or this might be a part of that, because it's pretty long. And I didn't even look him up. I didn't get around to that. I didn't even look him up to see what he's doing today or whatever, but he's the author of this. And so you have to know that it's quite, a lot of what's said is all said, you know, in favor of the Holocaust. He's written a lot about the Holocaust too, or he brings it in. You know, he's a total believer and all that. I'm starting in part two of this because a lot of it is the part one is in the history of this whole stuff, which I gave you of these nationalist organizations and so on, which I gave you already in a briefer form. And I'm not reading this straight through. I'm just taking out parts that I think are pertinent. It starts a little bit slow, but it picks up as we go along. So in September 1939, the destruction of the Polish state by, of course, the German invasion led to the looting of prosperous houses and stores, the murder of Jews and landlords, and the settling of personal scores. This social self-destruction was encouraged by Soviet occupation policy, designed to identify and remove potential sources of resistance. By summer 1941, the Volhynian educated classes had been deported to Siberia or Central Asia. These deportations were Soviet NKVD operations, but manpower was provided by the local militia, which in the Volhynian countryside was preponderantly Ukrainian and infiltrated by the OUN. Well, I guess I didn't give the... it'd be nice if you had a map or you looked up a map of this area at this time. But Poland, before the German invasion, Poland had in its territory in the southern part this strip from Ukraine. Oh, was that not... those were the Hungarians in the south. Well, wherever they had part of Ukraine there as Poland, and they had a bunch of Ukrainians. In fact, they had quite a lot of Ukrainians in this Polish second Polish Republic, and they were treating those Ukrainians very badly, as I already said. And then south of there was the Volhynia, where there were mostly Ukrainians and not so many Poles, but there were Poles there too, so they were mixed there, but it was like 5-1 Ukrainian over Poles there. So when the country came apart in September 1939 and October 1939, then the Ukrainians had their opportunity to take back this territory with the Ukrainians that had been part of Poland and create their Ukrainian national state and add it to the rest of Ukraine. Now, what happened was that in this mixed area of Volhynia, where you had Ukrainians and Poles, but the Ukrainians were in the majority. I don't know if it was 5-1 there after that, but they were stronger. Then the Ukrainians wanted to move out the Poles, either kill them or ship them somewhere, you know, make them go somewhere else, deport them or chase them away. And the Poles were fighting to stay and fighting for themselves, you know, fighting for their own survival there. And that's what was going on. So I think that tells the story pretty well. Now, the Soviet collectivization of agriculture in 1939, though incomplete, privileged corruption and theft. In 1941, the National Socialists placed their own colonists in charge of state farms. You know, the Germans decided to keep the state farms because they didn't think if they let them break up that there would be enough productivity going on, because the Ukrainians didn't have a very good record for productivity for all the people that needed to be fed. So they wanted to keep those keep the farmers on the state farms, but they'd be under the National Socialists, at least, you know, for the time being. Now, this Erich Koch was in charge of Ukraine for the Germans, and his administration did away with secondary schooling for Ukrainians, and he saw, well, this is Snyder talking, that the Germans just wanted to get the food, the raw materials, and so on. And so the Ukrainians were not too happy about that. The Germans, as I said, were not interested in furthering the Ukrainian nationalist cause. And, you know, if you've been following Table Talk, you can understand the reasoning behind it. And in any case, it certainly, there is solid reasoning behind it, because they're there to carry out their own mission and not to liberate all these countries to do their own thing and eventually kick the Germans out. That's what they would have done. So the Ukrainians in charge of local administration in the village and countryside were able to send Poles to the Reich as forced labor for a time, but soon had to send Ukrainians as well, Ukrainians who were working for the National Socialists. Erich Koch, well, this is Snyder. This is how Snyder writes. Erich Koch rejoiced in continual public murders of Jews in autumn 1941, of Ukrainian and Polish villagers pacified for real or imagined resistance, of Soviet prisoners of war starved to death in a camp, blah, blah, blah. The Holocaust in the Reichskommissariat was not a matter of railways and gas chambers, as in the general government. He's pointing out that what he believes happened in the Holocaust, but of short marches and shooting. So saying that they were taking these people out, the Jews mostly, a little ways outside of wherever they were, the village or whatever, and shooting them. The liquidation of the ghettos in 1942 was an SS operation, but it was implemented by about 1,400 Germans and about 12,000 Ukrainian policemen, showing the number of how most of this was being carried out by the Ukrainians employed by the Germans or working with the Germans. So it says, trying to tell us that it led to 150,000 Volhynian Jews taken to the killing fields. You don't know whether that's true or not, because it's all exaggerated. It says Ukrainians collaborated throughout November 1942. I guess collaborated with the German police in March and April 1943. In 1942, as the numbers of auxiliary police increased to meet the demands, what he says of the final solution, the OUNB agitated among them. So this is Bandera's group agitated among the auxiliary police who were working with the Wehrmacht. Now, part three, one constant from the pre-war period was an ideology of ethnic homogeneity. The OUN was founded in 1929 as an organization committed to removing all occupiers from Ukrainian soil. You see, and occupiers would also be the Germans. It arose from the disappointment of the destruction of the West Ukrainian Republic by Poland in 1919. Its members were typically Polish citizens from Galicia. A wartime constant from 1939 was a preoccupation with the future restoration of the Polish state. Both fractions of the OUN understood that Poland would not voluntarily relinquish Volhynia and Galicia after the war. And so they didn't trust working with the Poles against the Germans. As proponents of an independent Ukraine believed that the situation would resolve itself if populations were moved. That's what they thought was the best thing to do. In December 1941, the OUNM, the Melnik group, even proposed bilateral voluntary resettlements on the model of the German experiment to the Polish anti-Nazi resistance, the Home Army. So they liked the model of the Germans. They wanted to do it themselves to the Poles. The OUNB, Banderas Group, meant to expel the Poles from West Ukraine before the war was over. They weren't going to wait until the war was over because then maybe, I don't know, I would think maybe they thought they wouldn't be able to do it then. A guideline for OUNB task forces composed just before the German invasion in May 1941 indicates the desirability of the removal of Poles in the Western Ukrainian regions who have not abandoned their dreams of rebuilding a greater Poland at the expense of Ukrainian lands. That's what they said. You know, these Poles won't give up. And they're right. They're right. The Poles would never give up their idea of a greater Poland at the expense of the Ukrainians. So these people had an intractable division and fight between them, because they both wanted to control their lands and have their own national state, and some of it was they both claimed this part in Volhynia. By 1941, having experienced Soviet occupation, the OUNB no longer saw Poles as the main enemy, but they saw the Soviets, you see, as the main enemy, but the Poles were still to be removed as potential allies of Soviet power. Hans Frank, who was governor general of general government, which included the ex-Poland territory of Poland that was now a German general government, he accepted the formation of a Waffen-SS division in Galicia. But Koch, who was Reichskommissar of the Ukraine, interpreted the defeat at Stalingrad as a reason to press harder on the Ukrainian population in Volhynia. I don't know the reason for that, but that's what it says in Dalin, German Rule in Russia. You see, this is Snyder's, and he's got his footnotes here and why he says what he says, but I certainly haven't analyzed this whole thing. I'm just giving you the story. Autumn 1942, at least six separate partisan detachments from Belarus or eastern Ukraine had appeared in Volhynia. The Soviet partisans called themselves a movement, but they were controlled by a central staff. Then Stalingrad raised the stakes. After the Soviet victory of 2nd February 1943, more communist partisans moved into Volhynia. Soviet recruitment of local manpower after Stalingrad forced the issue. The OUNB sought to provide an alternative to elements of the Ukrainian nation who might otherwise seek shelter from German imperialism from Moscow. And this person named Lebed, who had been planning for such a contingency in 1942, began preparations. Okay, I got a part here I didn't read. I think I should read it. That the Stalingrad caused communist partisans to move into Volhynia. So it says, the OUNB had hoped to delay the formation. Okay, I'll do the whole thing. On 10 February 1943, the central staff of the Soviet Ukrainian partisan movement ordered new operations in Volhynia. The OUNB meeting on 17 to 21st February in 1943 responded by calling for the creation of a nationalist partisan army. They thought this was a good timing, obviously. The OUNB had hoped to delay the formation of this army for as long as possible, keeping its men in the relative safety of the German police or underground, and allowing the Red Army and Wehrmacht to exhaust each other in battle. See, this is the way they do it. They're no friends to the Germans. They only want to use them for what they need, and this is what everyone did. And the Germans knew that. Hitler knew that. He knew that this was not an idealistic thing going on amongst the Slavic countries against Russia and so on. Of course, they wanted to free themselves from the Soviet Union, but they also wanted to free themselves from everyone else, too, including the Germans. You know, he had his men in the German police. Or in the underground, and didn't want to bring them out into an openly declare war against everybody else, really, and try to win for themselves their national independence. But he found that he thought he needed to do it at this time, Bandera. So the Soviet recruitment of local manpower after Stalingrad forced the issue for him. The OUNB sought to provide an alternative to elements of the Ukrainian nation who might otherwise seek shelter from German imperialism from Moscow. And this Lebed, who had been planning for such a contingency in 1942, began preparations. So he was with the OUNB, Lebed. And Galicians with military experience, such as Roman Shukchev, and he comes up very important later, made their way to Volhynia. For Shchuchevich, who was 35 years of age, the logic of collaboration had just come to an end. Shukovich escaped as the Germans dissolved his police battalion. In early 1943, partisan commanders wished to corner the available manpower of fighting age before someone else did. And when Volhynians joined the various partisan armies for reasons of life and death, their experience in the forest and in the combat created or consolidated a political loyalty. Well, here he's talking about that these Volhynians didn't have any allegiance to the Soviets or to the partisans, but they often joined up with them because to save their own life or, you know, because they had nowhere else to go or whatever. And once they experienced the comradeship in the forest and in combat, they developed a political loyalty to the partisans and their way of thinking. That's what Snyder is telling us there. And then in part four, the German quota for forced labor in the Reichskommissariat Ukraine had just been increased. So, you know, at the time when these OUNB was deciding it needed to make its moves, and Ukrainian policemen were disgusted with this hunt for laborers, Ukrainian laborers to go to Germany, says, and Ukrainian policemen began to leave their posts. On 4th April, the OUNB promised death, that is revolutionary tribunals, to Ukrainians who remained in the German service. Now you see how strongly they turned against the Germans. And this is 1943 still. One UPA officer reckoned that about 50% of those who joined were forced to do so. That's what they say. As these policemen had provided the backbone of German authority, their departure weakened German power in the Volhynia countryside. The point's going to be here that when the German authority weakened in the Volhynia countryside, that's when these two sides went against each other and started creating so much bloodshed. You see, because the Germans were keeping them from doing that, and they were keeping the peace, and they were preventing these battles between the Poles and the Ukrainians and these massacres and so on. But they wanted to start carrying that out. That was really the plan, the Bandera's plan, to be able to destroy all these Poles and move them out. And that's what he wanted to start doing right then. And the Germans were in the way of that. So the OUNB had no wish to fight a full-scale war against the Germans, since its leaders believed after Stalingrad that the Germans would be driven out of Ukraine by the Red Army. So they didn't need to lose their men in fighting them. They would just wait and let the Soviets drive them out. But then they had to deal with the Soviets. So in Volhynia, local commanders saw the field opened for the removal of the Poles. That's what they want to do. Ukrainians outnumbered Poles by perhaps 5-1 in Volhynia when the cleansings began. And they were led by men trained in Lebed security services. That's the Ukrainians. By the German police. They were trained by the German police or by both because they were in the German police. The UPA, a liberation army, that's what it is, Ukrainian Liberation Army, killed about 7,000 unarmed men, women, and children in the first few days of the attacks in late March and early April 1943. All witnesses were in accord as to the basic shape of these events. Confused and withdrawing Soviet partisans reported that the UPA had undertaken a complete annihilation of the Poles of Ukraine. The head of the German police noted the withdrawal of Soviet partisans and ascribed ongoing attacks on Polish localities to the UPA, that these attacks were coming from this Ukrainian Liberation Army. The earliest available UPA report discussed the conquest of a Polish village. Two-thirds of the buildings were burned down. The battle lasted a few hours. The Poles give the number of their dead at 500. This was a UPA report. Throughout April and throughout Volhynia, UPA soldiers surrounded colonies and villages, burned houses, shot or forced back inside those who tried to escape. These people were brutal with one another. They gave nothing, you know. They had no pity. And this had been going on, though, I have to remind you again, for many, many years, and the Ukrainians were on the other end of it for a long time. So they were ready to win and be done with. You know, they had no feeling whatsoever for Poles. They didn't want them anywhere in their territory. They had to get rid of them. It says that in mixed settlements, the UPA Security Service warned the Ukrainians to flee by night and then kill everyone remaining at dawn. Now, part five, is that all I'm at? Five? It's what it says here. Poles now joined the Soviet partisans. So this drove the Poles into the arms of the Soviets and the Soviet partisans because they were being massacred by these Ukrainians. The taboo was broken, you know, their hatred of the Soviets, the Polish hatred of the Soviets was broken because their present needs trumped their past grievances. So as many as 5,000 to 7,000 Poles joined the Soviet partisans in Volhynia in 1943. They joined 900 to 1,500 Jewish fighters. They are fighting with the Jews now, that's for sure. Going on with it, as one Jewish survivor recalled in the spring of 1943, 15 Poles joined us. Their homes had been burned, and they barely escaped alive. They stayed with us for 4 to 5 months, and we fought the Banderites, the UPA, four times. Each time, Jews and Poles were killed, as were Banderites. Not far away was another small group of partisans, this one predominantly Polish, but including Jewish women. The Soviet commanders brought such groups under their control, leaving Poles and Jews, it appears, the numerical majority in Soviet partisan units in Volhynia. One nominally Polish unit of Soviet partisans, which was called Poland Is Not Yet Lost Battalion, had a Jewish husband and wife as commander and chief political officer. One must not imagine that most simple soldiers joined the Soviet partisans out of ideological commitment. Local Jews were in the forest to go and fight the Germans. They needed weapons and usually had little choice but to join the Soviet units. The Soviet partisans offered Poles the opportunity to pacify Ukrainian villages deemed to shelter nationalists. This made the UPA's task in Volhynia harder, but also simpler. Harder since the UPA had brought about the Soviet-Polish cooperation it had intended to preempt. Simpler because the cleansing of Poles now had both operational and propaganda significance in the UPA's more important struggle with the Soviets. Poles also retreated from the countryside to the towns and established self-defense units under German protection. By attacking German power and Polish populations at the same time, the UPA, the Ukrainians, drove them into each other's arms. The UPA's cleansing of the countryside also killed Jews who had survived the ghetto clearings. About 98.5% of Volhynia's Jews perished, he says. This is attributed to Spector in his Holocaust of Volhynian Jews, page 358. This proportion is unusually high for two reasons. First, relatively few Volhynian Jews had been deported by the Soviets to Siberia and Kazakhstan, where they would have been safer, actually, than where they were. And second, the UPA's 1943 attacks on Polish villages removed most remaining local shelter. So some Jews survived in the German-controlled towns in 1943 and even fought with the Polish self-defense units. On occasion, Polish self-defense units cooperated with the German police or Soviet partisans in attacks on Ukrainian villages because the Ukrainians had gone to war on everybody, including the Germans. So now the Germans were having to fight the Ukrainian nationalists, you see, and everyone else too. So you're on different sides sometimes with different people. A young Polish priest, somebody recalled fighting side by side with a young Polish priest whose name was Father Marian in a certain self-defense unit. Poles who had survived the first round of attacks were unsparing in their revenge. They had seen their houses burned and their families killed, often in the most horrifying ways. As a Polish historian summarized their mood, murder was reckoned a virtue. Young men who had lost their entire families notched their rifles to record the number of their victims. He continued, in the struggle with the UPA, the principle was not to take prisoners, nor were unarmed men spared. Well, then the Germans recruited about 1,200 fresh Polish policemen in April 1943 to replace the Ukrainian deserters, he says, Snyder says. Some stuff about that. And then by July 1943, a battalion of Polish policemen had been dispatched to rural Volhynia to pacify Ukrainian villages. That said, the auxiliary police remained heavily Ukrainian despite the desertion. So there's still a lot of Ukrainians loyal working with the Germans, but in spite of the desertions, which occurred during March and April. And Ukrainian policemen in the German service continued the pacification of villages, often Polish ones, suspected of sheltering Soviet partisans. Gets pretty confusing here. Ukrainians in the German police pacified Polish villages. Poles in the German police pacified Ukrainian villages. All served the German policies of maintaining local order and resisting Soviet incursions. The Germans were fighting the Soviets. Few could resist interpreting their experience in national terms. And that's really it. Everybody is thinking about their nationalism. Everybody is thinking about, their own national interest, you might say. And that's going to happen. And no matter how much people are on this side or now we're on this side, we'll fight with you, we'll fight with them. But it's all... In the end, what you can think in terms of your national interest, and of course, it comes down to your personal life too. Your survival, that comes into it in many cases. Over the course of 1943, perhaps 10,000 Ukrainian civilians were killed by Polish self-defense units. You see, so the Ukrainians were getting killed as well as the Poles. 10,000 in 1943. For the critical months of April to June 1943, in Volhynia, both the German police and the Soviet partisans were in significant measure composed of Polish recruits, and both committed unforgettable atrocities. All right, April and June 43, in Volhynia, the German police and the Soviet partisans were composed of Polish recruits. Both committed unforgettable atrocities, these Poles did. In this war of all against all, the UPA's nationalist message brought intellectual order to an otherwise incomprehensible situation. It just seemed like everybody was killing everybody, but the UPA had this nationalist message. And the particular conditions of wartime Volhynia allowed dedicated Ukrainian nationalists to provoke, explain, and win an ethnic war. Part 6 is titled Ethnic War, July to December 1943. By July 1943, the UPA had swollen to 20,000 soldiers and controlled all but the largest Volhynian settlements. Well, that's what they wanted. It had forcibly assimilated other nationalist partisan groups in Volhynia and organized recruitment drives and intelligence cells in villages across the region. It was in a position to make good its promise of shameful death to all Poles who remained in Ukraine. See, you wanted them to leave voluntarily and said that they would experience a shameful death if they didn't. As of March 1943, the Germans are trying to seize 3,000 people from Reich's commissariat, Ukraine, daily for forced labor in the Reich. That's what, let's see, the footnote for that is Tornicki, something, I don't know if it's Polish or Ukrainian. Somebody said that. I don't know. You know, I don't stand behind these figures. This is what's being put out there all the time. 3,000 people every day. 3,000 people a day to send them to the Reich for labor. I don't know. Then I have another little note here that says, footnote 90, the UPA kidnapped and then murdered the Czech wife of Taras Bulba, Borovets, in an unsuccessful attempt to gain his cooperation. That's interesting. As a Polish historian notes, the idea of robbery was nothing new, as they, the Ukrainians, were robbed daily. Moral degradation accompanied economic collapse, and Volhynian Ukrainians probably believed that land was what they needed. They were not the poorest Ukrainians under German rule, but they had lost the most during the war. To the east, in the famine-plagued formerly Soviet parts of the Reichskommissariat, 1941 and 1942 were the best harvests in memory. As recently as 1933, one region, just east of Polish Volhynia, had lost 15 to 20% of its population to famine. Although Volhynia was one of the most underdeveloped regions of Poland, it was wealthy in comparison to Soviet Ukraine. So for Volhynian Ukrainians, the collectivization policies of 1939 to 41 were an aberration which no one wished to continue. German attempts to preserve this system were resented in 1941, as were the increased requisitions of 1942. Volhynia, unlike the rest of the Reichskommissariat, had a private economy before the war. The genocide of Volhynia's Jews ruined what remained of this. Before the war, the occupational structures of Ukrainians and Jews in Volhynia had been complementary. See, this is Snyder. This is Snyder's ideas. And the Jews were the majority in the towns, the Ukrainians the majority in the countryside. That's so complementary, you see. And then he's talking about the final solution again. And Soviet deportations reduced the population of Volhynia's two largest towns, Rivne and Lutsk, by more than 50%. This was the Soviets deporting these people. Before the final solution in Volhynia, every Jew had a friendly Ukrainian farmer. Trade continued from the ghetto. When the Jews were murdered, the Ukrainian farmers lost their means of trade. By 1942, Volhynia's economy was one of barter. Oh, how terrible to have to barter. In July 1943, Ukrainian peasants must have been tempted by wheat that was ripening for harvest, golden and heavy in the fields. The present outlook was bleak, the future was uncertain, but a means of rescue seemed to be at hand. The Volhynian tradition of seizing lands from Poles in hard times was two centuries old, but now Polish property owners had no state to protect them, and Ukrainian peasants were organized by those who wished to build a state themselves. The UPA offered Volhynian Ukrainians an ideology of liberation and protection from Polish revenge. Well, that was sure to come. Its officers had guns in hand and moral justifications on their lips. By July 1943, all the young people had joined the UPA. That month, thousands of Ukrainian peasants joined in UPA attacks. Peasant sieves killed Poles, then reaped wheat from their fields. As the Ukrainian historian has delicately put it, quote, the support of the civilian Ukrainian population, armed with sieves, pitchforks, knives, and hatchets, imparted to the Volhynian events an especially bloody character. Yet the new peasant manpower served an organization capable of precise and detailed planning. On the night of 11-12 July 1943, the UPA attacked 167 localities and killed perhaps 10,000 Poles. Coordinated attacks continued through the summer as UPA commanders called for the destruction of Poles in quotes, servants of German and Russian imperialism, unquote, in their nests. Officers reported to headquarters that the Polish action was nearing its close, or that, quote, the Polish problem is basically resolved, unquote. The final wave of attacks fell on 25th December 1943, when Roman Catholic Poles, reckoning Christmas by the Gregorian calendar, were concentrated in flammable wooden churches. Oh, gosh. So the Ukrainians were winning over the Poles, but the Poles weren't entirely wiped out. Anyway, now we've got part seven, conclusions. The Volhynian cleansings of 1943 brought general civil war to the Ukrainian-Polish borderlands. The NKVD set about finishing the UPA's task, deporting remaining Poles westward to Poland. Then, as the Red Army secured Poland, Ukrainians were sent eastward to Soviet Ukraine. These repatriations of 1944 to 1946 were arranged by legal agreements between Polish communists and Soviet Ukraine, now once again extended west to include Bohemia and Galicia. In 1947, the new Polish communist regime forcibly dispersed most of its remaining Ukrainians from the southeast to the northwest, forcibly moved them of the country. Between April 1943 and August 1947, some 94% of the Polish population was removed from lands that became the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. 94% of the Polish population was removed from what was now the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. And some 95% of the Ukrainian population was forcibly resettled also from lands that became communist Poland. So the Soviets took charge and separated these people, completed that, but they didn't get their sovereign national state, did they? No. Says about 106,000 Polish and Ukrainian civilians lost their lives, and 1.4, almost 1.5 million, lost their homes. This final settlement, resettlement, of 1947 destroyed the UPA in Poland, which for the OUNB was a minor theater in any case. The UPA fought on with courage. The Ukrainians can show and have shown a lot of courage over the course of time when they have any kind of a chance at all, or even, you know, have any weapons to fight with. They fought with courage, tenacity, and brutality in Soviet Ukraine for another 5 years, still trying to get their independence. The UPA's war against the Soviet Union, the main task for which it had been created in spring 1943, was the most impressive example of popular resistance to communist power in wartime in post-war Europe. I do think that the Ukrainians are discriminated against by the powers that be, and including by the Russians, the Russians want to claim them and rule them, but the Russians don't treat them well or respect them. So they want some respect after all these years of being pushed around. I don't blame them. Goes on to say that this Roman Shukovich, the UPA's commander, the one who left the German police, you know, he was a Ukrainian policeman with the Germans, but he left there and took over as the commander. He died fighting in Soviet Ukraine in 1950. Wow, that's impressive, I think. Nikola Lebed, the UPA's founder, was recruited by U.S. intelligence. As World War shifted to Cold War, ethnic cleansing was forgotten. Neither the American nor the British government evinced an excessive interest in the past of Ukrainians recruited for difficult and risky anti-Soviet operations. The Soviets killed or exiled UPA soldiers and their families for the crime of opposing Soviet rule. The OUNB and UPA presented themselves as anti-communist organizations. The truth, though, not the whole truth. It was the truth, though not the whole truth. The Polish communist regime legitimized itself by its defeat of the UPA and its creation of ethnic homogeneity. communist pedagogy and scholarship in Poland and the Soviet Union alike insisted that ethnic groups had always been where they now were, and that present borders reflected ancient history. This, as we see, is manifestly false. The orthodoxy was not believed, but it did stifle historical investigation of the causes of population movement. Now, there you go. There's the thing that, you know, so many talk about, I've talked about. Here you have. It was the communists. And whoever went along with them that started saying that where these borders are now and where these groups are living now is where they always were. And these borders reflect ancient history. Our history has been so distorted. And some people hang on to the distortion. Some people want to correct it, or they go by the truth. And it's, and you find different things in different places. And it's just a mess. It's a mess. That's the story of the inter-ethnic fighting and clashes based on the nationalism. And I think it has a lot to tell us, or at least it's something we could reflect upon when we think in terms of a white people all being nationalists and coming together in a common cause. It was, they were not able to do it then in the 40s under some very strong German influence there and very strong German armies. But, and I don't think putting these people, allowing these people to go and fight on their own and arming them and so on was going to be what Germany needed. And that wouldn't have been at all. They had just turned on the Germans, as others have done. So, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for tuning in with me tonight. I hope it's been somewhat interesting. I think this last part was better than I thought it might be, so that's good. And I've already said I'm going to take some time off on Thanksgiving, but that will be announced coming up. I don't think there will be a show on Saturday, but there will be table talk on Thursday, and I'll give you all the latest then. So, thanks again. This is Carolyn Yeager saying goodnight for the Heretics Hour on November 17, 2014.